Bhagavatam Sarvati Sakshi Bhutam Bhavatitam Trigunarahitam Satgurum Tam Namami Tvameva Mata Chapita Tvameva Tvameva Bandhuscha Sakha Tvameva Tvameva Vidya Dravinam Tvameva Tvameva Sarvam Mama Deva Deva Tvameva Sarvam Mama Deva Deva
Please explain the difference between buddhi and will. Well, I suppose if you want to, where you would put the will, it would probably be in the buddhi. But the buddhi is much more than just the will. Buddhi has to do with clarity of thinking, with knowledge, with decisiveness, decision making. And so, say you decide to do something or you have the will to do that, that would certainly be the buddhi and not the manas, for instance. But the buddhi is just more than that. And the other thing that comes into that discussion about will is how much free will do we actually have? What is will, in fact? So if you think of will, really bringing the buddhi in at that point is good, where you have a determination, you make a sankalpa. But that sankalpa or that will is going to be contained within the prarabdha karma, you know. So the free will itself is only free within the scope of the prarabdha karma, you know. So it's not exactly free, it's conditioned. It's very conditioned because it comes out of the prarabdha karma. The prarabdha karma affects the whole jiva. The whole jiva upadi along with the situation that you find yourself in, so the will itself is quite conditioned. There's no such thing as absolute free will. But then if you look at will as a capacity, kind of like a muscle, you know, it's a capacity that you have, but that doesn't mean that the will that you have is stronger than the prarabdha karma or stronger than the situation. And even why do you make this determination, you have this sankalpa rather than this sankalpa, you know, because it's so conditioned, your free will is so conditioned by the prarabdha karma. They say things like that. What Swamiji said, though, these are many different layers of discussion, that free will is the free will you have is prayer, you know, because you're praying to Ishwara. So that's something to reflect on. Mm-hmm. Everything else in terms of here is so conditioned. You can't really well say that there's no free will. It's just that the free will is heavily conditioned, but that doesn't mean it's not there. Otherwise, there's no punya, there's no papa, you can't make sense of anything. There's no free will. It's just like we're an automaton, like a movie or something. Mm-hmm. You know? And that's not our experience. Our experience is that we do have free will. But I think even our experience without Vedanta is that free will is conditioned by a number of factors. Like, why do you choose this instead of that? It has so much to do with your conditioning, your environment, where you were born, the era that you're born into. So. Would you like to share anything about how it was for you to gain the knowledge? Was there any particular moments like, aha, now I know? There were different there were different moments, and all along, you know that you know, but then you know better. Mm-hmm. Even though what you knew is not wrong, but now you have more of a container that holds what you know and supports what you know, so you feel like it's your knowledge is more clear and more integrated with the totality of your experience. That keeps increasing, and so I had a lot of experiences of clarity in class when Swamiji was teaching, you know, where he's unfolding something and you're totally mesmerized, you know, by what he's teaching, and then all of a sudden you see it. And so that's a moment of knowledge, really. It's a moment of clarity. And then you have different kinds of experiences. I remember one that was, besides that one where I'm walking along and all of a sudden I realize I'm not moving as my body's moving. I do all this silly stuff to see if I'm really not moving. That was actually a big moment for me. There was a time also when I really understood the ahankara. How I just, for some, whatever reason, I just saw that ahankara rising. And then I had a choice for it to land on me or to land on the upadhi. And I saw the difference. What about when the aham, the I thought, comes, if it lands on you, on Brahman, on yourself, as opposed to landing on the upadhi? Because normally it's landing on the upadhi, and the upadhi is, you know, there's a mutual, what we call a mutual superimposition that is taking place between yourself and whatever the upadhi is, so that the body gains conscious being and conscious being becomes the body. Right, so the body becomes me and I become the body. That's the mutuality. It takes place in the mind. It's called anyonya adhyasa. That's another word we have to put on the board. It's mutual superimposition, anyonya adhyasa. I think there's actually lots of moments. Not just one moment. There's lots of moments. Even for the recognition of your own self, gaining that clarity in that, there's lots of moments of it's like a different level of recognizing that this is all Ishwara. Everything is Ishwara, your body, mind, sense organs, everything is Ishwara, and just letting Ishwara take care of things instead of you feeling like you have to take care of everything and figure it all out and make all these decisions. There comes a time more and more you give all that up. You don't really have to figure it out. You don't have to make all these decisions. I mean, you can if you want to, but you don't really need to. You don't really need to have all the worry and all these kind of things, because when it gets right down to it, the prarabdha karma, which is Ishwara, is unfolding. And you're included in that unfoldment, along with a lot of other things. Like an infinite number of cause-effect relationships are included in every moment that's unfolding. And so if you really think that you want to make it different, you're going to have to make a lot of things different. You know, it's not just this body, mind, sense organs, everything is included in a much more integrated whole, you know, and so you are taken care of as part of, like a cell in the body, as part of that integrated whole. So I think where, in terms of the happiness in your life, what really makes the difference is your knowledge, actually, the way that you handle your experiences. That's what makes a difference. It's not so much how you change the experiences. Like, I want this experience instead of that experience. That's not so fruitful. What really matters is how you are with the experiences that you have, in terms of your ananda or your shanti or your feeling a part of things. You're feeling not isolated, you know, feeling loved, feeling wanted. That all has to do with the attitude with which you are, that you have as you're experiencing. That if that attitude is loaded with knowledge, is an effect of your, you know, is a product of your knowledge, of your self-knowledge, then the life is a lot easier. You give up a lot of this kartritvam, this doership, you know, and you give a lot of the responsibility to Ishvara in terms of trust. That, as Swamiji would say, you know, if it's in your prarabdha, if it's going to happen, it'll happen. If it's not, then it won't. Sounds pretty obvious, you know. But what if you kind of live by that? It doesn't at all mean to become slovenly or just, oh, okay, not like that. It allows you to be very, very alert and very present and on top of the actual life that you have. Be organized, to be efficient, to be engaged in the life that you have instead of in the life, the projected life of the future. So I think the anyway, the whole idea of free will is becomes mitya, maya. It goes into, in every which way you look at it, goes into this infinite regress with no real solution. And yet we have free will. Would you say that the inner critic is part of the manas or the buddhi? Is it okay to wish for more guided inner child meditations? I've been asked that, and I'm going to do that. I kind of did it today because I know some people would kind of like to have a deeper appreciation of that. So I'm going to talk during part of our talks, psychology talks. We'll talk about that in a little bit more depth, and I will do some more guided meditations for people who haven't, for those of us who haven't had a lot of experience with it. I'm going to do more guided meditations, and the people that are very comfortable with that, then my voice can just be background music. Yeah. And you can just be doing your own process, but I'll do some more directed meditations as people ask me for that. What's the other question? That's an interesting question. Do you think the inner critic is part of the manas or the buddhi? What I actually, just thinking about it now, if I have to place it somewhere, I think that the inner critic actually comes up from the unconscious. And it has been something that has been introjected, depending on, say if your mother or father was very critical. It was their personality, that a very critical personality, and so they were always telling you you weren't good enough, or you have to do this a little better, or I'm not happy with the way you did this, but I did a criticism all the time. Then you tend to internalize that when you're little. And then that, in a Freudian sense, that starts becoming like the superego. That's the one that is always kind of talking to you. We'd say that's the buddhi, but it's the buddhi that's contaminated by the contaminated buddhi. Because the buddhi is the one who's looking and judging and making suggestions and kind of directing the manas and directing your life with some clarity. But what if the one who's directing it is really this inner critic, kind of the superego that's superimposed upon the buddhi, kind of a negative voice, you know? This inner critic, we pick it up when we're young, and it's usually a quality that our parents, one of our parents has. Somehow we've interjected it at a young age, and so that you don't even notice it. I found that you have to ask people to start listening to how they talk to themselves, because it's so unconscious. Even though this talk is going on all the time, it's been going on all the time since you're little. And so, again, it's like background noise that you're barely listening to, but it can be very negative noise. You know, always complaining about you. You know, you've not done this right, or you, I don't like the way you've done this, or you don't look good, or you don't dress right, or all on and on and on and on. It's just, ooh, I like this. But if you ask somebody to start paying attention to how they talk to themselves, then you'll start to hear if you're talking, if these voices are talking to you in a way that's supportive and loving and makes you want to live, you know, or if it's this kind of a deadly negative, always complaining, you know, saying you didn't do this right, you didn't do this well enough. That creates a really oppressive inner home. So if you think of all the little ones and all the things going on inside as your home ground, and it's filled with these parental figures that are inner critics, as though, you know. And so you can never be home in yourself and relax. It's never comfortable to be home. And so it's imperative, honestly, that these inner critics are transformed. I don't think it's that hard to do either. It's a matter of first become conscious of it, of that voice, and then you have to talk to that voice. You have to say something like, you know, all you say, you're just always saying critical things. You're just always criticizing. That's what you do. And the reason you do it, it's not your fault that you do that. You're doing that because that's how you were treated when you were little. And so then you've just learned how to do that. That's all that you do. That's all you know how to do. But you don't have to do it. Let's not do it anymore. Instead of being critical, let's try being helpful. So from now on, we're going to be helpful, not critical. We're going to be loving and supportive, not critical and tearing down. Because we can change that, because it's not your fault that you picked it up in the first place. So, which is true, you know. It's like your mind, and when you're young, your mind doesn't, or your buddhi is barely operational, actually, when you're young. Your mind doesn't say, oh, good, you know, let's internalize this inner critic and have that be the one that's talking to me all the time. Yeah, we would never do that. But the fact is that the parents or the babysitter or whoever is the caretakers are criticizing you all the time. And so that's what you internalize. And if they were building you up all of the time, you know, loving what you do, loving your creativity, you know, always seeing the good, you know, then you're filled up with that. You know, always kind of being understanding and trying to help and giving guidance. And it's not that there's no discipline, but there's loving guidance instead of a disciplinarian critic. So it's a much different inner space, but we can make our inner space like that. Part of the inner child work is that the inner friend is like that. The inner friend replaces the inner critic or whatever whatever other types of personality types the inner critic stands for. You know, the one who's mean. You don't want to have a mean person inside. How can you relax? We can't. If there's a mean person outside, we can't relax. What about if you're carrying one around with you? So it's kind of serious, because it creates such a painful inner space. And not that hard to change. So, and very important to change, because you'll feel so much better. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Question on that. The unconscious, where do we put that? Because it seems that would almost be chitta, because it's based on things that we've been through.
It could be, well, you know, of course, in the Upanishads, they don't have what we call the unconscious. So that it's not going to be put in anywhere. We have to decide where to put it. Mm-hmm. So you can put it into the chitta. We also have things that suggest an unconscious, like the vasanas, samskaras, raga dveshas, there's another word for that one we use, besides, it's raga dveshas, but it's like in the form of vasana, something like that. where you have definite preferences. You know, you want to have repeat experiences of the ananda that a particular experience has given you. You want to do that again, so you have a raga. Or you have negative experiences, so you have a dvesha for that. So those are like lodging there inside of the unconscious. But they don't have this word or concept of the unconscious. Kashayas also point to an unconscious. You know, when you're meditating and things just come up, they say, as though out of nowhere. So that and vasana, samskara, these ideas, you know, subtle likes and dislikes, point to an unconscious. But that's a Western 200-year-old concept. So we have to integrate it.
And so what is vasana?
Vasana, it actually means, just in common language, it means a fragrance. Okay, so vasana, the word vasana means a fragrance. So imagine having like a beautiful rose, you know, or a bouquet of roses. It has a beautiful fragrance. And then you take the roses outside, put them in another room, but the fragrance remains. The fragrance is subtle, it remains. The roses have been taken out. And so they use that example in understanding a vasana. Like, say, you had a happy experience, right? And what you're left with, maybe the particular spirit experience goes away, but there's the memory of the happiness that experience caused, brought about. So you have a vasana for that, redoing that experience in some form or another so that you can enjoy the happiness that it brought you. And so in that line vein, it can be very subtle. Like, say you meet somebody who, say, looks in a particular way or has a particular accent or wears a particular type of clothes. And somehow, even unconsciously, without you having to think about it, it invokes a very positive response. Like, you really like that person. For no real reason, except maybe it was the accent, you know, and the person that you really loved had the same accent. Or so there's a vasana, there's a holdover from the prior experience that then can get triggered by something similar in the present. Does that make sense? Also, you can say we have a vasana for coffee. In India, you know, the Madras coffee is like the greatest thing in the world. So for Madrasis, you know, nothing like having Madras coffee and that best cup of coffee. And so you really look forward to having it in the morning because you have such good experiences. It gives so much ananda, you know. So let's have our coffee. Let's get the Madras coffee. Why? Because I have a vasana. What's the vasana? That raga, because of the pleasure it gave me before. Or I ends up turning into something negative because I get so shaky when I have that much caffeine. So because it gave me the shakes, I don't want to have that Madras coffee. Whatever, that would be negative. But you remember the experience. The experience is triggered by the new experience. It carries over. So that means it's subtle, lurking around inside, and we would say in the unconscious. Maybe, you know, we would put it in the chitta, but then divide the chitta up into different layers of consciousness, where it goes into a more unconscious layer, like a vasana. If we wanted to try to superimpose the West onto the East. Mm-hmm.
Sounds kind of like preferences. They have that influence your preference. But is it something that comes from only our actions in this life? Or is it lingering? And then that puts in the question of what is samskara then, if that's...
Samskara and vasanas can in some ways be interchangeable. Mm-hmm. But vasanas, I think, have more of a tendency to be in this life. And samskaras... Mm-hmm. Art can be in this life too, and that way they can be kind of used in the same way. But we also think of them, oh, you brought those Vedanta samskaras with you. You know, those tendencies with you as part of the prarabdha karma, who you were before, what was important to you before, especially in terms of knowledge, because Krishna says in the Bhagavad Gita, you pick up where you left off, you know. And so that means there has to be a samskara there, like a tendency or something that needs to be fulfilled in this life. So if we say that there's a lot of samskaras coming over from the past life, we don't really know that, and yet we experience it. Sometimes we experience little children, you know, who are able to play the tabla or something. I think I told that story when we were in about 1972. We were at the Sandipani Samalaya in Puai, where Swamiji was holding a course. And there was a great big, the temple had a great big kind of hall that we would, we would meet there some evenings, and Swamiji knew so many musicians that they would come and entertain often. Because Swamiji had such a beautiful voice, he had so much music himself that people would all often come. And so one time this group, kind of a well-known group, they had different instruments, but a lot of different kinds of drums, but also, I don't know, with all the things that they have there, the sitar and various different instruments and vocals. But sitting right at the front was this little boy that, not even a little boy, he was a baby. He was just old enough to sit. And there he was sitting, this little tiny baby, really kind of like the, you know, the size of Bhumi. That's what, I mean, little baby. Sitting cross-legged like a little yogi, right up in the front. And they were playing this music, Indian music. They were well-known musicians, I guess. They were all the Swamiji's people. And this baby started, when they were playing, beating out with his hand a perfect tala. That's not easy. I mean, that's complicated. And he was doing it. You know, let's just imagine Bhumi. and then one by one we all started watching this baby, because when we saw the people, the musicians starting to notice, because the baby was right up in front, you know. And so the musicians were starting one by one to notice this baby and then playing to the baby and you know how they go, like that, and enthralled by this little baby with its perfect tala, and then Swamiji was watching, everybody was watching. That's amazing. That's something coming over, you know. A little baby like that doesn't learn the tala, how to do that. You know, it was just incredible. It's just a tiny baby. And you should have seen the joy of the musicians as they were playing and watching this little child keep up. Yeah. Those are some scars. So things come over, you know. And why are some people so accomplished in something like math or something in like tennis, you know, some sport, something like that, or music? You know, sometimes you can. Sometimes I see this on YouTube. Or on Facebook, where there's a little 3-year-old, you know, a lot of times Japanese or Chinese, playing like Bach or some absolutely incredible thing, really into it. They're like 3 or 4 years old. How is that? You know, that's something amazing. Those are all things brought over. If one applies Bhagat Tyaga Lakshana within Mithya, what are the partial things we'd better drop off first? Partial perspective, sense of separateness. What are your thoughts about it? Well, Bhagatyaga Lakshana is, all of these Lakshanas, first of all, there's something that happens very naturally. It's not like you really think of them, think about them. We'll be doing all of the Lakshanas, I probably will. There's different kinds of Lakshanas. They don't require much thought because the vacharta, the immediate meaning of the word, doesn't make sense, and so your mind will automatically fill in. Like I gave the example of, oh, Swamiji lives right on the Ganga. He probably didn't even think about it. He's not living on the Ganga. He's living on the bank. So bank has to, of the Ganga. The bank has to replace the Ganga, but your mind just automatically does it. And so something like Bhagatyaga Lakshana, the things that are contradictory in the statement have to drop off to understand what you actually mean. So like, for instance, if the example that we used in the Panchadashi was this Soyam Devadattaha, Saha Ayam Devadattaha. That boy in the third grade named Devadatta, that is this guy who is right here now, 50 years later. So we have to drop off the time and the place and recognize the person who was that little boy and who is this older person now. So those, the little boy, you know, that lived in Chennai and this older person that lives in Mumbai, you know, they look quite different. They're in a different place. It's a different time. So the different place and the different time has to be dropped off so that you can, and you see the person that was the little boy and the older person. You see that. That's Bhagatyaga Lakshana. Another Bhagatyaga Lakshana is the wave ocean. If you recognize, you know, the waves are the ocean, you know. The waves in the ocean are nothing. The waves are water. The ocean is water. So if I say the ocean waves, there's nothing but water there. You know, I have to drop off the nama rupa to understand that there's only one body of water. We can look at the whole body of water and call it the ocean, or we can look at all the waves, you know, and call those the individual waves. But really, there's nothing there but water. To say there's nothing there but water, I have to drop off the ocean and I have to drop off the wave, recognizing that they're all mitya and the truth of it is only the water. So those are just in the world examples of the Bhagatyaga Lakshana. There's other Lakshanas, like I gave the example of, I see a group of horses running and one of them is red. I say, hey, look at the red running. And you automatically fill in the red horse. You don't give me a lecture on how red doesn't run. You automatically do that. So these are some of the three main lakshanas. Where in one, like the Ganga and the banks, Ganga, the banks have to replace the Ganga for the red. The red has to add the horse. But you have to add a horse to the red. In the Bhagatyaga lakshana, you have to get rid of the things that are contradictory, leaving what is actually there, the truth of the both of them. So those are three major lakshanas that we use, and we use them because the immediate meaning of the word doesn't work. That's why we do it. So. Mm-hmm. In verse 59, it's talked about how Nirvikalpa Samadhi removes all karmas, etc. I thought this happens during Shravanam in relation to Samadhi because my ahankar shifts. I thought this happens during Shravanam in relation to Samadhi because my ahankar shifts. And Lot lands on Brahman, who is not a doer. I've previously mainly heard emphasized that we're not so interested in Samadhi as Vedanta students. We don't usually talk that much about Samadhi or Savikalpa Samadhi, but Vidyaranya does things a little bit differently in that way. But there is samadhi and there is nirvikalpa samadhi, but we have to be careful when we talk about it that we're talking about it in terms of knowledge. gaining knowledge as opposed to just an experience. So you can have a nirvikalpa samadhi experience with no ajnana being removed. Then you come back from that experience and you just want to have the experience again because you know that it's the truth. You don't know what that truth is, but you do know that that is real and that is true. But you think you, the jiva, has just had this very real experience. So the ahankara hasn't, the ajnana hasn't budged. The ahankara hasn't moved at all. Yeah. And so that's why we don't talk about samadhi and nirvikalpa samadhi, savikalpa and nirvikalpa samadhi just alone by themselves. Because that's just really a vritti. You know, as a samadhi is a vritti. Even though it's an ati sukshma vritti, means that it's so absorbed in the self, there's no subject-object differentiation at that time. It's still just a vritti, no jnana has been removed. So that's why it's not really talked about. In Shravana, when Shravana is taking place, depending on the type of unfoldment that happens to be happening, there will be, if the Mahavakya is being unfolded, there will be a moment of seeing. That's an akhanda akhara vritti. So we talk about samadhi, sevikalpa samadhi, and nirvikalpa samadhi in terms of this akhanda akhara vritti. So the vritti, whose akhara, whose nature is akhanda, free from subject-object division. Akhanda means undivided. So a vritti whose nature is undivided, what's undivided? There's no subject-object relationship there. There's just the Atma, just the self. And so the unfoldment will result of the Shravanam can result in that akhandakata vritti. So that's the word that we would usually use instead of savikalpa and nirvikalpa, though we unfold that those words just so that they're known in the context of Vedanta. Okay, that's good. Is that enough? That's enough for tonight, I think. We only have a few more. We'll finish. We'll keep working on them.
Swasti prajapyah paripalayantam nyayena margena mahim mahishah ko brahmanebhyah shubhamastu nityam loka samasta sukhino bhavantu kale varshatu parjanyah prithivi sasya shayani Desho yamcho parahitaha brahmana santo nirbhayaha Om sarvesham swastir bhavatu sarvesham shantir bhavatu sarvesham purnam bhavatu sarvesham mangalam bhavatu Sarve bhavantu sukhinah, sarve santu niramayah, sarve bhadrani pashyantu, ma kaschit dukha bhag bhavet, asato ma satgamaya, tamaso ma jyotirgamaya, mrityorma amritam gamaya, Om Purnamadah Purnamidam Purnat Purnamudachyate Purnasya Purnamadaya Purnameva Vashishyate Om Shanti 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 Hari Om Shri Gurupyo Namah